Just checking, I'm going for time. Close time is 4 o'clock, isn't it? 4:30? No, but I finish at 4. Is that right? 10 after. Ah, the second contentious. Do you understand that first part? Shall I reread it? Okay. The second contentious piece of family-related legislation in New Zealand that I'm to speak about is the criminalisation of spanking, or smacking, as it is called down under. When I first wrote that first sentence in preparing this talk, I read back and realised that I had, carrying on from the prostitution section, my mind was so there about decriminalisation that I had written decriminalisation of spanking. Ironically, with the passing of these two pieces of legislation, one form of spanking has indeed been decriminalised. Greg, I hear from Andrea. Greg. In all seriousness, these two changes within the same decade offer a fascinating insight into some prevailing ideas in New Zealand culture. I flippantly referred to the broadening ban on smoking in New Zealand that has been advanced on the grounds that some personal choices should be curbed because of the unavoidable consequences of those choices, both on the individual and, in the case of passive smoking, others in the smokers' community. Prostitution, however, is viewed in a different light. It is apparently an activity whose consequences can be alleviated or even removed. At the very least, in New Zealand, choice trumps consequences. Clearly, there are much deeper assumptions at play here. I'm well aware of that, around the nature of humans and sex. But the point around human autonomy is nevertheless an important one. It's one of the reasons why the mission statement of Maximum Institute is to foster the ideas and leadership for a more free, just and compassionate New Zealand. We constantly come back to the nature of freedom, of justice and compassion. For our understanding of those three terms, and critically the anthropology that informs them, will very much shape our entire approach to policy and culture. There we go. At Maximum Institute, we run residential internship programs twice a year, and MPs regularly come and hold extended and very open conversations with the interns. We're very fortunate. We get senior ministers, and because of our mixed member proportional representation system, we have a number of political parties, and all the parties are happy to send representatives out there and enjoy engaging with our bright young things. In February of this year, one current minister shared that his ultimate vision for society would be anarchy. It's quite serious. As a committed libertarian, he genuinely believes that it is governmental restraint that most stands in the way of true human flourishing. Implicit in such a vision is a very hopeful and positive view of human nature. Whilst I'm persuaded by the benefits of smaller government, I can't share that same utopian ideal, I guess, which is one of the reasons why I'm a political conservative and not a libertarian, at least defined in New Zealand political vernacular. Our assumptions around human freedom, and I use this word assumptions because in most cases our belief systems, our worldview goes uncritiqued, are critical to how we approach such legislative questions, and this point was amplified during New Zealand's extended and ongoing debate around spanking. As with the prostitution debate, there were some admirable motivations to those seeking a law change. Our country has a lamentable record of child abuse, one of the worst in the developed world, and people everywhere are desperate to see it addressed. The MP who sponsored the smacking bill, as it was known, Sue Bradford, genuinely believed that it was our defence of parents spanking their children that fostered a culture of violence. She could not see any difference between spanking and abuse, and she consistently and persuasively argued that children should be protected from assault, just as adults are. The second part of that sentence is crucial. Throughout her political career, Sue, I call her that because we became friends who have a great deal of respect for each other, we just disagree on pretty much everything, was fueled by a commitment to advancing the rights of children. Significantly, she saw children not primarily in the context of their families, but rather as mini adults who needed to be empowered in much the same way as women and racial groups had been liberated in the past. So I was aware of this when Yona said this morning, quoted the leader of their Social Democrat Party saying it is the right of children to go to daycare. That is very much the language we have in New Zealand. I find it particularly interesting given that for 9 years in New Zealand, just about through almost the entire first decade of the century, our Prime Minister then, Helen Clark, was very much a disciple of Sweden. One of those parts that suited her framework, certainly the ideological framework. In fact, you may encounter her at the United Nations work. She's now number three in the United Nations, actually. So a very, very influential woman. This was a view shared implicitly or explicitly by many other MPs and advisers. Hence, during that same decade, there were also calls, thankfully unsuccessful calls, for the lowering of both the voting age and the age of sexual consent. My former colleague Dr. Michael Reid authored a book for Maxim in 2005 titled From Innocence to Agents. In it, he chronicled the growth of the child's rights movement in the Western world and looked particular at some New Zealand applications of those ideas. I want to quote him now. He said, "For much of Western history, children have been considered in the context of the family, which has provided for their support, protection and care. But in the later decades of the 20th century, children moved from being viewed as innocents in need of protection to being politicised agents with autonomous rights guaranteed by the state. Together with a new balance between local and international law, the state has shifted from supporting the authority in place of families to supporting the emancipation of children from their parents and the support structures which make for their well-being." I can see someone writing that down, so I'll leave that up for a moment. One of Michael's case studies was the debate around Section 59 of the New Zealand Crimes Act. That part of our law that provided a defence for parents against the charge of assault if they spanked or smacked their children. Now, in order for that defence to succeed, the defendant had to show that A, the force used was reasonable, and B, that it was for the purpose of correction. At the time of writing his book, the bill to repeal Section 59 had just been introduced to Parliament. In fact, I remember my then 7-year-old son, Harry, he was the eldest one in that picture before, saying to me, because often I'd come home from work moaning about the legislation that we were battling at that time. He said to me, "Old Dad, is the government introducing yet another bad law? What's it this time?" I replied, "They want to make it illegal for parents to spank their kids." Harry gleefully exclaimed, "A good one at last!" He reminds me regularly of this new law, and we'll actually see some stats around the number of kids that are doing that. In critiquing the proposed law change, we argued that parents should retain physical authority over their children. With assault defined as an intentional application of force or a threat to apply it, that's legally what it means in New Zealand statute, the absence of the defence would clearly present a challenge for parents. For instance, even enforcing time out would technically be a crime because you would, in the most cases, have to restrain the child into placing them into time out. That would be assault against an adult were you to do the same. There is no longer a defence against assault. You would now be committing a criminal activity with no defence. In the previous 15 to 20 years, there were a handful of court cases where it is arguable that defendants were able to use the defence where they shouldn't have been. You can argue that the jury or the judge got it wrong. Now, these cases were obviously highlighted frequently by the law change supporters, who also misrepresented the facts of other cases, and in some cases overemphasised the facts of those reasonable cases. And we argued for an amendment to tighten up the law to reduce the likelihood of improper cases, yet still allow parents to give their children a light smack, and critically, to retain physical authority for parents over their children. The proposed legislation was a private member's bill, not a government measure, and thus, like the prostitution law, it made very slow progress through our parliament. The public debate was heated, protracted, and the lobbying from both sides was intense. On the eve of the final vote, it appeared that the bill would likely succeed, but the parliament would largely divide along party lines. This was important in that it gave the bill's opponents, like ourselves, some hope that even if the law passed, the issue could be relitigated at the upcoming general election that was just a few months away, and then likely repealed by an incoming Conservative government. However, in a surprise move, the then Leader of the Opposition, now Prime Minister John Key, met with then Prime Minister Helen Clark and agreed a late night amendment to the bill in return for the full support of his party, all MPs, regardless of how they personally felt. Up to that point, it had been a conscience vote. The amendment simply stated that the police would have discretion not to prosecute parents if doing so would not be in the public interest. In essence, smacking would be illegal, but the ban might not be enforced. The bill thus passed with an overwhelming majority, including the support of all the whipped Conservative MPs. Smacking was out, but whipping was okay. I didn't get a Greg that time. Opponents of the new law soon embarked on a citizens-initiated referendum and secured the necessary signatures. It was only the fourth time in New Zealand history that that's been successful. The referendum was held 6 months into the term of the new government, led by the now Prime Minister John Key, who had reiterated his enthusiasm for that new law. The referendum returned a result of 87% support for decriminalising smacking. But within hours of its announcement, the Prime Minister ruled out any chance of a law change. So the referendums are not binding in New Zealand, only indicative, but clearly the indication couldn't have been much more pronounced. It was indeed an interesting time in New Zealand politics. We didn't really know where to go after that. Since then, polls have continued to show similar levels of support. In the most recent one in March of this year, 82% of parents responded yes to the question, do you think the new law should be changed to state explicitly that parents who give their children a smack that is reasonable and for the purpose of correction are not breaking the law? It was almost exactly the same question as the referendum, showing that public sentiment is really not changing. The same poll also for the first time explored what impact the law change was having on parents, and in answer to has the anti-smacking law made you less confident as a parent when dealing with unacceptable behaviour from your child, 21% said yes, which surprised me that it was that high that quickly. Given that it's really only been a couple of years. And interestingly, to the question, has your child ever said that they would tell the authorities, like a teacher, social worker, or the police if you smacked them, 32%, nearly one-third, said yes. Some of them may have been in jest, like my son, or like all my kids regularly do. But I fear that most of them were not. One of our intern alumni from Maxim Institute is currently completing her Masters in Social Policy and will then very likely convert it to a PhD thesis. Her thesis is presently examining similar questions to those questions there, those second two there. She's looking at the effect of the spanking law on New Zealand parents. Her full results won't be available for several more weeks, but in reading last week through her draft summaries, it's clear that some, if not many parents, are finding their confidence eroded by the new law, and many don't understand what the law actually says. They just really feel at sea as to terms of what they can and can't do with their children, which is what we argued when opposing that law. What I find particularly curious about the politics of this law change is the degree to which the same government that doesn't seem to make the slightest policy announcement without rigorously poll testing it displays on this issue such resolve in the face of overwhelming public opposition. On the downside, I suggest it illustrates just how deeply held are the ideas which have shaped much of our social policy in recent years. But on the upside, it illustrates that lurking within the timid, poll-sensitive shadows is perhaps sufficient political courage to make some of the changes that my country so urgently needs. One of the hopes currently fermenting in New Zealand is a program of social delivery called Whanau Ora. It came about as part of the coalition negotiations between the National and Maori political parties after the 2008 election. In essence, it is a devolving to the community level, the delivery of various social services, and at the heart of it is a belief that primary relationships are pivotal. Whanau Ora literally translates as family health or family strength. In contrast to most of New Zealand culture, our native people have never accepted the story of individualism. Indeed, it's anathema to their whole framework of life, where the individual only finds their identity in the context of their whānau, their extended family, both living and generations past. Tradition, knowledge and understanding are not created anew by each generation, rather they are treasured and passed down through the ages. Now this can obviously be taken to extremes, and at times this one glory creates much trouble for New Zealand, but in essence I do see it as a real light ahead for New Zealand. A fortnight ago I met the kamatoa, the elders of the Manurewa Marae, which is now housing the frontline social work that I mentioned earlier, the Te Whakaora Tangata work. The first third of our meeting was spent on sharing our stories, our family's journey, explaining our home and our primary relationships. The Marae, a Maori meeting place, is owned by the community and not individuals, and our whole conversation was around how our shared work can restore and support families. Ironically and sadly, the present social statistics on family are far worse for Maori than for other people groups. But I observe that that is not a consequence of a changed anthropology. They are very clear on what it truly means to be human. Rather, they are struggling with intergenerational cycles of family dysfunction. But there are clear reasons behind that that I do believe can be addressed. We have the right foundation to start from. Hence, approaches like whānau ora and at a micro level, te whaka ora, implicitly recognise that the only way to break those cycles is to reinvigorate the health of the family, focus on restoring relationships, and have those who know and love the individuals be the ones to deliver that support. Such a countercultural approach in New Zealand could realistically only be forged by Maori. As our first people, their beliefs and values in the 21st century are held in the highest esteem. For example, grace is seldom now said at official ceremonies, but karakias are a common feature of public meetings. A karakia is simply a Maori prayer. Maori know far better than the present dominant culture that no man is an island. They have the stage to advance that, and they have clearly signalled that we need to follow policy directions where families and communities are strengthened. Their leadership in the area of family policy is, I believe, one source of real hope in New Zealand. Wes and I were talking last night about strategy. He works for the Manning Centre, and he was saying one of the questions that they regularly ask the people that they're training to consider is, who is the best spokesperson for this? And inherent in what I've just laid out there is very much our answer, that we believe the Maori people are the ones to take this countercultural approach forward. For several decades now, the story that has most shaped my country's culture and policy has been that of the liberated individual, unfettered from the claims of family or neighbour. But I genuinely believe that that story is beginning to unravel. There's a dawning realisation of the link between that story and the endemic fracturing of families and relationships. I see it in conversations with high school and college students, in the unguarded remarks of media commentators and academics, and in the candid reflections of a few courageous, only a few, but they are there, political leaders. Now, this story won't unravel quickly. After all, its roots go back 400 years. But unravel it will. In spite of the direction of New Zealand policy and legislation these past 10 years, I have real hope for our country. And I look forward to, 20 years from now, New Zealand being used by Canada as a model rather than a warning. Thank you very much.